Well, hello once again, everybody, and welcome back. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. Tonight, a remarkable program. You're going to want to pay close attention to this one. In fact, it's going to be unforgettable for some of you, since the newest deadly round of death and dying has burst forth into the round Jerusalem and the occupied territories for these many weeks now. One theme, one concept, seems constantly in the news: the Temple Mount and its intense importance to both Jew and Palestinian alike. But what if the temple site is wrong? What if the temple is located somewhere else? This evening, a fascinating visit with Dr. Ernest Martin, archaeologist, theologian, and biblical scholar whose work indicates just that. Next. It is well known that Herod, called the Great, vastly modified the geography of the temple and the city of Jerusalem. Herod made the mother city of the Jewish people into one of the most urbanized areas in the Roman Empire. So outstanding, in fact, did Jerusalem become under his rule that it was favorably compared in structural and architectural majesty, grandeur, and prosperity with Rome itself and other great cities of the Roman Empire. What Herod also did was to rebuild and increase the size of the temple. Next to the sanctuary, he reconditioned a fortress formerly called the Baris and renamed it Fort Antonia after Mark Antony. To the west of the temple, Herod constructed his own palace and three major citadels in what was then called the Upper City. In spite of these remarkable accomplishments that scholars recognize today, people are still not aware what the Jerusalem of Herod and Jesus was really like. The book, authored by my guest tonight, entitled The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot, will tell us much about that enigma. So let's welcome, without further ado, Dr. Ernest L. Martin to the program. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show, Jeff.
You're very welcome. Let me, if I might, just for a moment or two, Dr. Martin, tell our listeners a little bit about you. He has taught history for 12 years.
History and theology, primarily.
In England.
Over the past 40 years.
Yeah, and 12 years in England.
Yes, 14 years in actual fact, and well over a year of my life in Israel, primarily in Jerusalem. That is aggregately over about 31 times that I've been down there.
31?
Yes, but I've stayed there for several months at a time, working with Professor Mazar, Benjamin Mazar, that is, from the Hebrew University, right on the south wall of what is called the Temple Mount, but I am showing in my book that it's not the case. It's called the Haram HaShabib, and I worked there with Professor Mazar for five summers from 1969 to 1974. And I do know the area very well, and of course I go back quite frequently, and my work in history and theology, biblical, Christian primarily, but also Jewish and Muslim, it involves that area of the world very much indeed. And of course, the whole attention of the world at this very moment is on that very site. So it's certainly contemporary as far as relevance is concerned.
Well, I guess if there was ever a timeless city, that has to be it.
Well, indeed. There's so many enigmas with that city that all of us realize. The very name means City of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably has had more wars associated with that place than any other in history.
Imagine the carnage when you total it all up.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And we're still seeing the problems involved there to this very day. Most of them are centered around religious beliefs. Now, I'm so thankful, and I know you are, that we live in the United States of America, where we can practice our own religious beliefs, and we should be able to do that. There is not one of us or two of us together that will agree on everything. We know that. But when religious beliefs come down to very survival and people are at war with one another over them, this can be a great problem, and it's happened in history, and certainly is happening at the present time in Jerusalem.
It is ironic, isn't it, how religion, all great religions basically are saying essentially the same things. The golden rule is universal.
Oh, it really is. And you know, ethically and morally and things of, and even socially, we find that religion has its place, and we wouldn't want to do without it. But at the same time, there are doctrinal beliefs that impinge upon land and areas of worth that people want to live in, and people squabble over them, and finally they get belligerent over them.
Well, and then eventually they kill over them.
Yes.
Dr. Martin, you have spent so much of your life there. You have so many friends and colleagues. Your reputation is truly international, and deservedly so. I think what we need to do, if we can, we've got plenty of time tonight, is go back and help many of our listeners understand really what Jerusalem was, who Herod was, what the temple was. A lot of people don't have a good grasp of that. They understand the term temple. They understand it's a location, but they really don't have a good historical bedrock. So without going into a PhD mode here, I think what we ought to do is tell people more about the temple, Jerusalem, and why it's so doggone important now.
Yes, I think that's a very important aspect, simply because most of us have imagined through our Sunday school teaching that the area at the time of Jesus and Herod was made up primarily of people herding donkeys and camels and things of that nature, and that the city of Jerusalem was very much like some Middle Eastern city we could find out in the Sahara or in Central Arabia or something of that nature. We got to realize, however, that that was not the case. It was quite a civilized area. It was a modern part of the Roman Empire. At the very time, the empire was at its greatest under Augustus Caesar and Tiberius, and on down to Titus and Vespasian. That first century B.C. and also A.D. was a time of great prosperity for Jerusalem.
In a way, Jerusalem, and we don't think of it in this way, but Jerusalem was almost a sister city of Rome, and any other great city of the was the Roman Empire.
Absolutely, and some of the buildings there, including the temple, and this building I'm going to be talking about, Fort Antonio, as well as Herod's palace up in the upper city, in the east, western part of the city, were compared with the majesty of Egypt, even with the great pyramids and many of the other buildings that we see still to this day in Rome. For example, the Colosseum. The Colosseum was built in 79 A.D. Mm-hmm. That's right in that period of time there. And we've got to imagine that Jerusalem was very similar. It had amphitheaters there. It had a hippodrome, which was a racetrack. Herod was quite a lover of Greek culture and architecture, and he built a grand city that would have been one of the greatest majestic cities in the world at the time, and even we ourselves would be amazed at the splendor of that. Now we can go to there to this very day and go up to the Mount of Olives, and you can look westward over the Kedron Valley, and you can see the remains of the Haram Sharif, that is that rectangular building with the Wailing Wall on the western side over there. And we see the Wailing Wall on television almost daily, and you can see those gigantic stones that make up that four-walled Haram. And they are just awesome to look at. I mean, even from our 21st century perspective, you have to imagine a society that was quite sophisticated and wealthy and socially and religiously acceptable to even our own terms today.
Yeah, culturally it was up to speed with everything that Rome had to offer.
Without question.
How is it then that contemporary reflex analysis and opinion of Jerusalem comes back with, as you said, basically a very simple agrarian, a kind of a sedentary little town that didn't matter much back then?
Yes, so that is the normal impression, and I think that that is has been promoted primarily by books about Jerusalem in the past century. When you go back to the last century and look at what Jerusalem was like, it was simply a very quaint Turkish Middle Eastern town. Very dirty, very unkempt, very, if you love the Middle Eastern spices, which by the way I do, you can get those all over the place, but, animals could just wander practically anywhere, and, until the British came in, in 1918, and modernized the city, Jerusalem was indeed a very, old-looking, quaint-appearing, city of the Dark Ages.
Did it just erode over the millennia, or was it ravaged and savaged by wars?
Both. They were savaged at various times by wars, and then it went into decadence mainly because of neglect, particularly in the 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries. There was very little done to the city, and it was really a backwater of civilization.
Well, Dark Ages.
And you could not even really want to live there. In fact, up to the last part of the 19th century, it was unsafe to even drink the water or the food in the area that was grown there.
Yeah, it had regressed back to its original roots almost. You know, I just read a story recently that I put up on my website that points out unequivocally now that what triggered the so-called Dark Ages really apparently was a celestial cosmic event, probably an impact on the planet, that actually did turn the skies dark for a period of time and did create the environment of what we call the Dark Ages.
I believe that to be true, and I think that that occurred, no doubt, in the 6th century A.D. with ramifications, that is, other things happening in up until the time of the Muslim invasion of the Middle East and later. But
well,
the period from 6 to from around 500, the middle of the 500s, to the middle of the 700s, a 200-year period, this Earth was subjected to some kind of force that dilapidated the whole thing. I mean, it brought on the Dark Age, let's put it that way.
We're going to take a break here in just a moment. In fact, the tree rings that have been examined recently by British scientists show that very thing. And trees don't lie, and the record is there that something happened to change the world environment, its climate, for a long period of time, which, if you think about it, it doesn't take much to tip civilization as we know it backward if things change so radically. And they did. We now have real proof of that. We'll be right back with Dr. Ernest Martin as we continue to discuss and plumb his remarkable book. It truly is a landmark book called The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot. And welcome back. I'm Jeff Rentz with Dr. Ernest L. Martin. The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot is the book. We're going to tell you how to get that book as we continued. It is a remarkable book put together by one of the world's great scholars and archaeologists, not to mention theologians, Dr. Ernest L. Martin. We're talking a little bit about Jerusalem, which went into severe decline during the Dark Ages, of course, and lasted, they lasted for a long time. I guess the Crusades were the next great period in which Jerusalem became an icon of culture as it was then. Tell us about the Crusades a bit, Dr. Martin, and what they meant to Jerusalem and vice versa.
They are a very important period of time simply because that is when the Jewish authorities gave up the original temple site for the temples that were being aspired to by the Christians and the Muslims. And when the Crusades were over, we find that the whole geography of Jerusalem had changed. In actual fact, as far as Jewish participation in the period, from 1099, at the very beginning of the Crusades, that is when Jerusalem was taken by the Europeans, our European forces, there was not a Jew that lived in the city of Jerusalem or even got near it for a little over 50 years. And when they went back, they found a Jerusalem that was entirely different. Now, at that time, however, many of our, I should say the European forces, many of the people were literally illiterate, and were unable to, because of the Dark Ages that had come along.
Right.
But when they came into this area of the Middle East, they found a highly sophisticated Arabic culture that many of them inherited, and they liked very much, and it brought back temporarily a type of renaissance to Europe, and many of the beginning of the universities in Europe started as a result of crusaders being in the Middle East, coming in contact with highly developed Arabic and Muslim culture, and then more or less ending the Dark Ages. Now, there was a time in the 1300s when the Black Death came along, and that put people back a long way, but then with the Protestant Reformation, we really inherited much from the Arabic people as a result of the Crusades. But Jerusalem itself suffered tremendously after the Crusades were over. The Crusaders actually tore that city practically to smithereens, and the rock underneath the Dome of the Rock, they took chippings of it back to Europe that one Arabic commentator thought there was more parts of the rock in Istanbul and throughout Europe than there was left in Jerusalem.
Wow, well, that's another sad comment on history and what people do, not to mention the number of people who were slaughtered on both sides. How long did the Crusades last again? It was a long period of time. It wasn't just 10 or 20 years. It was...
Well, it could be stretched over a 200-year period.
Yeah, it was a long time.
In Palestine itself, in Jerusalem, about 100 years.
Yeah.
And, people taking Jerusalem off and on. It was in European hands from 1099 up to 1087 when Saladin, the Kurdish Muslim conqueror, came back and reestablished Muslim rule in the area. And one more time, the Europeans were able to take Jerusalem again. But then the battles that took place there, as you were saying, they just ravaged the countryside and changed the city of Jerusalem from what it was earlier on into practically a devastation. There were no walls around Jerusalem after the Crusades until Solomon the Magnificent, the Turkish ruler in 1538, built the present walls we find around the old city of Jerusalem.
Interesting. Without spending a whole lot of time, I don't want to gloss over the magnificence of Arabic civilization, which existed when Europe was literally in the dark. The mathematicians, the philosophers, the writers were absolutely unparalleled, I guess, in known culture at that time. The zenith of the Arabs was marvelous, and one day I'll do a program on that because it is a forgotten epoch in so-called Western history, which needs more of, I think, more attention.
Jeff, I hope you will do that. You're absolutely right. And astronomy, too, was developed cultivation at that time.
I mean, they made the Europeans look like peasants. At that period of time.
Not the case.
Yeah.
We Europeans, I'm assuming we're all, I am and you are, we come from that area of the world, but we learned so much from them during that classical period of time, from about the 8th century A.D. on up to about the 13th.
They pulled Europe back up, I think, out
they
of the
did.
Gutter. Let's tell it like it is. We will continue to do so with Dr. Ernest L. Martin in just a couple of minutes. We'll take some calls later on tonight as well. We are going to trace the temple and the Dome of the Rock and all the rest of it so you have a better understanding after tonight's program about what all the bloodshed, dying, and strife is really all about in the Middle East. And we shall continue in just a couple minutes. On that little high note, we'll come right back with you and my guest, Dr. Ernest L. Martin. His book, The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot, can be yours. simply by writing to you. All I have to do is take out your checkbook or get a money order. It's 486 pages, soft cover. Every scholar, everyone interested in religion as it pertains to our current events and our life in general, ought to read this remarkably well-researched and documented viewpoint that the temple is not where most people think it is. It's not that far away, but it's not where people think it is today. The book is The Temples of Jerusalem Forgot, 486 pages, $24.95. And that's plus shipping, Dr. Martin, or?
No, with shipping.
Oh, that's delivered. That's a good
one. Yeah, that's with the postage.
All right, keeping it simple, $24.95, and all you have to do is write to Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, or just ASK, make it simple, ASK, P.O. Box 25,000, 25,000, 25,000, Portland, Oregon, 97298. We'll give you more information on how to get the book as we continue. The book by Dr. Martin is the result of his conclusive research that shows that the temples of God in Jerusalem were indeed located not where people currently think, but over, well, we'll get to that point in just a minute. Let's build a little drama here. It's a, quite a dramatic story, actually. Tell us what the temples of God were, who built them, just for everyone so we don't leave anybody behind, and what the significance is.
All right. Well, in actual fact, the first temple or sanctuary was not a building of stone at all. It was a tent, and it was. And most of us know the stories that we've learned from childhood about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt under Moses. Within the first year of that exodus journey, Moses ordered that a tent, a tabernacle, as it was called, was to be built, with three major compartments to it. Mm-hmm. A court for the Israelites on the outside, and then an inner part for the priest, and then, and most inner part called the Holy of Holies, where the high priest would go in once a year.
That was a pretty big tent.
Well, it was about 100 cubits, well, about, shall I say, about 100 or so feet, I should say, wide and a little longer than that.
Okay.
It could be carted from place to place.
Uh-huh.
And we're told in the Bible that there was a cloud that would be hovering over it during the daytime and a light at night. Now, that was the first temple. In actual fact, it was a temple. Once they went into the land of Canaan, however, and conquered that, they set that tabernacle up at a place called Shiloh, which is about 35 miles north of Jerusalem. Jerusalem didn't even figure into this at first. Now, we're going from around the 15th century B.C. when Moses was leading the children out of Egypt, but it came down to the time of David and Solomon, about 1000 B.C., 500 years later, before the temple was finally constructed out of stone in Jerusalem, and that was done by Solomon, the son of King David. That temple existed there until the early 500s B.C., when it was destroyed by the Babylonians under King Nebuchadnezzar. It stayed in complete ruins with no stones on top of one another for about 70 years. And then we have this story in the Bible how under a person by the name of Zerubbabel and the high priest Joshua, they built a new temple, much insignificant to the other, and in the same place, and it stayed there on the Temple Mount in the city of David until it was destroyed to being like a hull of a building in the time of the Maccabees. That goes down to the middle of the 2nd century B.C.
Dr. Martin, hold on.
And finally, in the 1st century B.C., near the end, around 20 B.C., just before the time of Jesus, King Herod rebuilt the temple on a grandiose style, doubling its size.
Okay.
Josephus said, to make a long story short here, that it was a square type of a building, and it was 600 feet by 600 feet on each side, a square,
yeah,
and that it was 450 feet high. That's about a 45-story building.
That's huge. Now, I wanted to interrupt you back there and ask to clarify for people what the Temple Mount is. A lot of people don't know, and if we want to kind of keep this thing just in logical progression, they put this on the Temple Mount. Give us a description of the Temple Mount.
Absolutely. If a person would go to an atlas or look in the back of most Bibles, there are maps which will show where the city of David was located in the southeastern corner of Jerusalem. That area was known as Mount Zion. And Mount Zion was a geographical term that was synonymous with the Temple Mount. Now, there were two hills there. One was Zion itself, and just to the north, the Bible says there was another one called the Ophel.
Mm-hmm.
Ophel means a swelling. It wasn't a high peak type of a mountain, but it was rather rounded on the top. And those two mountains, Zion and Ophel, together represented the city of David. And it was on the Ophel where Solomon built the temple. And he built it directly over the only spring, natural water spring, that there is in the Jerusalem area. It was called the Gihon Spring. And this was all on the southeastern corner, Jeff, of the city of Jerusalem, even as it is in this very day. And that was the original city of David.
All right. Now, hold on. The temple that was built, you're describing something that was 45 stories tall?
In the time of King Herod, not the time of kings. It's got quite a history to it, as you know. Herod's temple was 450 feet from the bottom of the Kedron Valley on the southeast corner.
Okay. Not
the northeast corner. It was only about 300 there. And it was about 200 on the northwest corner. But on the southeast corner, the very place where Jesus was taken, it was called the Pinnacle in the New Testament, where he was taken by Satan, you know, to jump off.
Uh-huh.
That was the 450-foot length. That,
right.
And you could not even really see, Josephus, who was an eyewitness to this, said you couldn't even really see the bottom of the Kedron Valley if you would look down. It was so dizzy. You get dizzy doing it.
That's extraordinary. Hold on, if you will, Dr. Martin, we're going to take another break.
Okay.
Most people listening had no idea of the size of this structure. It's enormous, and I want to ask you, how do we know that it really was that big? Are we 100% sure about the dimensions and so on and so forth? As an archaeologist and a theologian and a biblical scholar, Dr. Martin, as you've heard, dozens of trips to the area, and he's been there. I'll be back in just a couple minutes. Stay right there. Dozens of trips. I had written 41 instead of 31. Dr. Martin has been in the area of Jerusalem working over many years for a total of 31 visits and more to come, I would assume. Yes, Dr. Martin?
Well, I hope so. It's a little difficult to go down there right now, as we all know, and some of the areas I would like to visit and some of the people I would like to see about this very matter are so occupied with the problems that it's not the nicest place on earth to be.
Yes, as your host and friend, I would suggest you hold off a little longer.
Ada, thank you.
Yeah. I'm trying to put this picture in my mind of a 600 by 600, that's two football, American football fields on a side by 450 feet tall building. And this was what year again?
Herod started the rebuilding of this to that size. He doubled the size of the former temple to that size that you gave right there.
Yeah.
And he did that starting in around 20 BC.
Right,
it was certainly that size when Jesus was here, and he was talking about the temple, when he was inside the temple, and he was referring to it. That was the temple that he meant.
Was this just a temple, or was it office buildings? Was it also, this is, had to be one of the most imposing structures of the ancient world period.
Actually, what it was a tower that had an interior to it, mainly of stairwells, so that you could get up to the top. There was a platform on the top, and three different levels, very small levels up there on top, and that is actually where the temple courts were. It was in this 600-foot square building, like a penthouse, more or less, on top of a building. If you go to Los Angeles or up here in Portland, for example. There's some 45-story buildings here and then occupy about a whole block.
Yeah.
So that would be a very good description of what the temple was like.
But
on top of that, on top of the platform, is where the actual temple was, with its three different compartments, and where the priests did their administration.
So it was essentially a large block structure. Not, I don't want to use the term pyramid, but it was pyramidal in design. It was mostly rock and block.
As a matter of comparison, Jeff, the pyramid, the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt, is in height. It's slightly smaller than the temple would have been. Believe it or not, it would have been one of the wonders of the world if it would have continued to exist to this day.
That's my point. It had to take a heck of a lot of effort to tear the thing down.
Absolutely, and that is what Jesus said, and that's one of the reasons why I have written my book, is to show that his prophetic teachings concerning that temple, that not one stone would be left on top of another, has indeed taken place. You cannot find any stones that in that area that would suggest that the temple actually existed that way. But we have the eyewitness accounts of Josephus, the Jewish historian, who accompanied Titus and the Roman legions there at the time of the destruction of the temple from 66 to 70 A.D. And his eyewitness account is cogent. It is absolutely accurate. He never makes a mistake on what he is saying as far as measurements are concerned. But our scholar friends, including me, up to about 10 years ago, 5 years ago, really, we would just say that Josephus had to be exaggerating in what he was saying, because there is nothing with the Haram Sharif, that is what we call the Temple Mount today, up at the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, none of those stones up there fit what Josephus says at all. And they just absolutely do not. And another thing that surprised people when they go to Jerusalem for the first time, and if they're Christians and they are well aware of the prophetic teachings in Matthew 24 about Jesus saying that the stones would not be on top of one another, they are rather aghast to find these gigantic stones, over 10,000 of them, still intact in their pristine condition in this rectangular building, which was north of the temple, about 1,000 feet, really 600 feet on one side, but I mean up to the Dome of the Rock is about 1,000 feet north of where the temple actually was.
That creates a little bit of a problem. On the one hand, if you look at things the way you and your associates have determined them, Jesus looks magnificent in terms of his prophecy. On the other hand, people adhering to the current location would have a little reconciliation, wouldn't they?
They would, and definitely so.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that when I took my wife down there for the first time to see this, her question was, well, there should not be any stones there. It took me a little bit of ingenuity to explain, as I did in those days, and that most of us, most scholars would assume to be the case, to be able to justify Jesus somewhat, is to say that he was not talking about the outer walls of the temple, but only the inner.
I remember that argument. I've heard that in the past.
That is normally the one that that makes us breathe a little easier, you see. However, that is not what he means, because as I explain in my book, when that prophecy was given in Matthew 24 about the stones not being one on another, they were outside the temple and looking back at the temple, the exterior walls at that time. And clearly in the Bible, the walls were as much a part of the temple as the building itself. And when you read Josephus' description of the city of Jerusalem, not only the temple, but the city after the Roman War was over in 70 A.D., he said that any person who would come there, having seen the city before, would not even believe there was once a city in the area.
And
it was so devastated.
Now, they didn't have explosives back then either. They had to pull these apart with, what, slave labor? And
that is correct, and the reason for it is explained by Josephus himself. He said that after the war was over, the Jews, or most people in the Middle East at that time, they did not have banks like we have today. They would hide their gold, usually in a wall of their homes, or something of that nature. Frequently, they would move it from one place to another, and they would cement it up, you know.
Sure.
And the temple itself was a repository of great wealth. It was just like our Fort Knox for all practical
purposes. Oh, so the motive was goodies.
Oh, absolutely. And when the fires began to demolish the city, much of that gold began to melt and trickle down into the rubble. And for the next 6 months after the war was over, they left the 10th Legion there of 5,000 soldiers to supervise the slaves, the Jewish slaves that they still had.
Uh-huh.
And what they did, they turned every stone there was of that city upside down looking for the gold.
Is that where the expression came from?
That's exactly it.
Is that right?
That is it. And the price of gold, Josephus said,
uh-huh,
went down a half throughout the whole of the eastern part of the Roman Empire because of the gold that was taken from the ruins of Jerusalem.
50% because of the flooding of the market with new gold.
Yes, exactly.
Cut the cost in half.
In half.
That's extraordinary.
It really is. And that caused a depression to take place in the eastern part of the empire. That was quickly overcome. But then they were able to revive themselves. But Jerusalem was left in complete shambles. And as I said, Josephus gives the description, and even Titus, who was the son of the emperor and later emperor himself, and he was the general in charge of the Roman armies at the time, he made a trip after the destruction was over up to Antioch and came back about 6 months later, and he made the statement that if I had not have been here and conducted this war, I would not have realized there was a city in this area.
Oh, that's amazing.
Absolutely torn down to all the walls, every block of stone torn up. And that's what Jesus said for the whole city of Jerusalem would take place in the 19th chapter of Luke. I know it's rather astounding for his prophecy there. But
when did he say it would happen?
What Josephus says as an eyewitness, there you are. I have it in the book.
When did Jesus predict that this utter demolition would occur?
In 30 AD, just about 2 days before his crucifixion.
Uh-huh.
It's found in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, the general prophecy.
What time frame did he say this damage would occur? The destruction?
He did not. It was within the framework of the end of the age.
Mm-hmm.
He did not designate when that would be. In fact, the disciples asked him, when will the end of the age be? And he said that he did not know, neither the angels in heaven, but his Father. That's what he said at that time. And in Matthew 24 and 25, he gives quite a good deal of teaching there to tell the disciples that they really wouldn't know the precise time.
Mm-hmm.
But the way he was talking, they surmised it would be soon. And obviously 30 A.D., in 66 is when the Jews went to war with the Romans. They were expecting the Messiah to come at that time, in that period of time. And as a result, the Romans brought their legions down, and after about 3.5 years, they left Jerusalem in shambles and exactly fulfilling the prophecies that Jesus said. So it all took place within a generation. Now, there are lots of scholars who feel that many of these prophecies have an end time, repetitious type of a meaning to them. And that type of interpretation has been around for a long time. But the initial prophecies were fulfilled from 66 to 70 A.D.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll talk more about prophecy as we continue. That's our first hour. The book is The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot, an exhaustively well-researched and brilliantly footnoted book by Dr. Ernest L. Martin, available to ASK, P.O. Box 25,000, Portland, Oregon, 97298. That's ASK, P.O. Box 25000, Portland, Oregon, 97298. $24.95 gets the book delivered to your door. 486 pages of extraordinary history come to life by the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. We'll be back. Hour number two coming up in just a few minutes. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're here. Hope you find this interesting as we look at history as it pertains to today and tomorrow. Be right back.